and welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 20, The Spartan Yoke. Welcome back indeed, dear listeners. 10 days into the new year, and the hangover I served up to myself during New Year's Eve celebrations seems a distant memory, hopefully along with the struggles of 2020. I trust you all had a safe break and managed some time with family, whether in person or virtually. I had a couple of weeks off from work during the period and spent practically every day swimming with little Leonidas. In Brisbane, where I live, the weather rarely drops below 30 degrees Celsius throughout summer, and if it does, the 80 to 90% humidity allows little reprieve. It's been great to be back podcasting once more, so without further ado, let's get back into it. In Book 15 of his Annals, Tacitus wrote, "Great empires are not maintained by timidity." Although one should never accuse the Spartans of having a timid nature, if empires are subjected to apathy or passivity by their masters, the result would inevitably be one and the same. At the end of the 8th century, this is precisely the situation in Sparta. Having battled for control of neighbouring Messene for 20 years, the land-hungry Laconians defeated their Dorian cousins in the so-called First Messenian War. With victory came the fertile valley of the Pamissos River, an enslaved people to work its fecund soil and hegemony over nearly two-fifths of the Peloponnesian Peninsula and its most arable land. A state that had been thoroughly revolutionised via Lycurgan reforms would be one reliably placed to exert dominion over an influx of possessions, both agrarian and human in nature. However, that was not the Sparta of reality at the time. Certainly, and as we'll see, it was to be the often violent evolutions that occur over the next century that would bring about a place more akin with the one attributed to Lycurgus. When Rome had spread her influence across the Mediterranean, or our sea as the Latins called it, a government well versed in managing a city proved insufficient, incapable, and incompatible with handling a transmarine empire. Pressures both internal and external contrived to completely revolutionise the Roman Republic, leaving it as an autocracy whose iron grip extended its tendrils from the Palatine Hill. Only a microcosm by comparison, Sparta, 700 years before the rise of Augustus, was to face similar issues of control over its recently extended borders. Reform was needed, but like the protracted conflicts of late Republican Rome, the Lacedaemonians still had some hard lessons to learn first. The period from 800 to 700 BCE saw rapid growth of the Spartan state from a collection of four villages on the banks of the Eurotas to the largest controlled territory known to that time in Greece. Despite the advent of later institutions, at this early period, the city was run by a style of oligarchic government with the preponderance of power residing in the households of wealthy landowning families. It was likely this disparity that led the Laconians into the ambitious land grab westwards in Messenia in the first place. Having achieved dominion over their neighbours, perhaps some of the dissenting voices at home were quelled, with new tracts of land for distribution. The battle between the haves and the have-nots was to continue, however, and divisive, unresolved issues lead to a rift in the social fabric of the city's inhabitants. Moreover, regional domination and greed will lead into conflict with Sparta's powerful neighbour to the northeast, the Argives. Descendants and namesakes of the Homeric heroes, the armies of Argos prove a match to the Spartan troops, at a time when their legendary invincibility had yet to be a thing proven by success. The most serious issue they had to contend with came from the recently indentured Messenian Helots. The Spartan yoke weighed heavily upon the previously free and proud people of the region. Dorian cousins of their new masters, the respective homes of the Laconians and the Messenians are separated by the imposing Taygetus mountain range. Even today, there is no easy passage from the Eurotas to the Pamissos watershed. Uprising and rebellion from this quarter was to be a continuous concern for the Spartans, one that necessitated vice-like control from master to slave. Nevertheless, we've all seen where this story leads. Despite these adversities, the Spartans eventually rise to preeminence in Greece, smashing the Persians in land-based warfare at Plataea in 479 BCE. If the men of King Leonidas' stand at Thermopylae were to meet their forefathers in the 8th century, they would scarcely recognise each other. So much had the Laconian identity changed in the preceding years. This episode will focus on the events that led up to the late 7th century social revolution within Sparta. Following episodes will deal with those changes directly. As I take the story through the next 50 years or so of Spartan history, we'll see the influences and factors that brought about the revolution. The state of our subject at the end will resemble more closely the Spartans of legend, the ones who spat in the face of the King of Kings, austere, resolute, and obedient to their laws. So, We've got quite a lot to get through in this episode if I'm to bring it to the point I envision, roughly the 650 BCE mark. Before we get into that, a quick comment is in order, one that is probably a little overdue. For anyone that's been with me since the start, my style of exhaustive detail will come as no surprise. To anyone new to the show, or for those who have joined since the Spartan narrative truly got going, this is for you. Sparta's history is one of several dichotomies. The first I wanted to separate was the difference between the Bronze and the Iron Age. In an attempt to properly set out the pre-Homeric era of the city through its legends, I got more than a little sidetracked. Knowing full well I wouldn't be back to the Heroic Age anytime soon, I thought I'd have a little fun with some of my favourite legends. Finally, I took a fairly low-resolution approach to the climactic close of the era with two episodes on the Bronze Age collapse. Afterwards, we looked at the transitory, or Dark Age, that bifurcated the Bronze and Iron Ages. Coming into this later phase, there are once more two Spartas. One is the echo of a distant and removed history, the Spartan formation story pre-Thermopylae, and the other is what is often called the Spartan Mirage, which encompasses the classical period. The imagined ideals of what was to outsiders an alien-like society. But it wasn't just an external view. It was a heavily propagandized concept promoted from deep within Laconia to the rest of the Greek world that was eagerly peeking over the Taygetus mountain ranges in fascination. To say the archaic phase of Sparta's evolution is convoluted would be a gross understatement. One of the premier scholars in ancient Greece in the 20th century, Victor Ehrenberg, described this period as a battleground for modern historians, which, in order to achieve any sort of coherent chronicle, one had to engage in intellectual gymnastics. Just so, the balance between what we know for sure, which is little, between what we have to infer, which is much, is a tenuous game. The earliest prose records for the city come from the 5th century BCE, with Herodotus and Thucydides, and only get less contemporary from there. Plutarch and Pausanias offer the most complete look at pre-classical Sparta, but, writing from nearly a millennia after the period, their historicity has to be accepted very carefully indeed. We know of many of their sources, and some are downright Hellenistic rumour mongers, and others couldn't help but anachronise the past due to their present perceptions. As I said back in episode 15 on Lycurgus, the period from 800 to 480 BCE is the real Spartan story. The idea is that by the time we make it to the Greco-Persian Wars, we'll completely understand the reasons why 301 men, counting Leonidas, and their defeat could leave such an indelible impression upon history. In that vein, I'm keeping the detail high, cranking up the resolution, and doing my very best to leave no stone unturned in the virtually untold story of pre-classical Sparta. Now don't get me wrong, it's a tale that's out there to be sure. You can be guaranteed that I'm not clever enough to figure it all out myself. It's just not one focused on by popular history in this day and age, and the omission has always struck me as an oversight, one I hope to avoid. I just have to stress finally that everything I offer during this era is my best guess hypothesis, having taken in as much relevant scholastic and archaeological information as my brain can process. We, that is the human race as a whole, just don't know the truth, and failing some miraculous find of lost texts in the sands of Egypt, we may never know it either. I'd personally love some complete copies of Alcman and Tyrtaeus' poetry. That would really help. Okay. We finished the last episode by covering Sparta's absolute victory over their westward neighbours, the Messenians. This was no simple border dispute or conflict over herds of cattle, but an outright fight for survival, of which regional hegemony and dominance was the final prize. At a time when most other cities were beginning to send out colonies and migrations to ease population burden at home, we looked at possible reasons why the Spartans decided to expand locally. I really left the Messenian question hanging, wrapping things up as soon as the war was successfully concluded in Sparta's favour. No peace treaty as such, or idea of formal settlement comes down to us, and an attempt to formulate a best-case scenario was just too laborious to get into at that time. Let's turn directly to a post-war Sparta in the last quarter of the 8th century BCE. It is understood by academia that this initial conflict with Messenia yielded for the victor control of only the upper reaches of the Pamasus Valley, which, along with the Eurotas Valley, consists some of the most fertile land in all of Greece. Starting to the west of the northern Taygetus mountain range terminus, the Pamasus flows in a generally southerly route along the western foreshore of those mountains and empties between the first and second southern peninsulas of the Peloponnese. Having a drainage basin of some 560 square kilometres, it's imagined that this was the extent of land-bound acquisitions for the Spartans at war's end. Knowing what we know of the Laconians up until this point, it makes sense that they wished for only fertile and arable land to ameliorate the civil rest back home. The rest of the land was left to perioecic communities. Back home, with the Eurotas Valley already divided amongst the rich and powerful of the city, there would have been many who felt aggrieved at not having their fair chance at full enfranchisement of citizenship. And there was nothing like a war to give the people something else to worry about, a collective goal to work towards for the betterment of the polis as a whole. Did that war satisfy the disenfranchised? The next 50 years would prove that it didn't. The first cracks in a supposedly unified Sparta appear in the year 706 BCE. The traditional dating for the founding of Taras, modern Taranto located on the instep of Italy's boot, and its first inhabitants were Spartan. Barely a generation after significant new tracts of land were acquired by Sparta, the city's population troubles required her to send out a colony to ease the pressure. But considering the losses of life a 20-year war would have incurred, and all that extra land gained in said war, a colonial expedition to ease population doesn't hold water as a theory. Making more sense would be the possibility that the internal strife leading to the First Mycenaean War had not been resolved with its conclusion. It had, in fact, compounded the issue. To understand the reason for this move by Sparta, we can take a quick look at the foundation legend of Taras and tease out possible indicators of trouble at home. It is a story of a group of men known as the Parthenii, quite literally, the sons of virgins. There are a few theories relating to the creation of this faction, but rest assured, they are not distant relatives of Jesus Christ. At the outset of the war, the Spartiates swore an oath to stay in the field until its conclusion. Those that didn't commit and sat out the fight became the first of yet another stratification of Spartan society, the tressantes, a term used to denote a trembler. Consequently, with victory over the Mycenaeans completed, these tremblers were excluded from not only the spoils of war, but also their citizenship. They plotted against the homoioi and were discovered in their perfidy. And being banished from Laconia, they founded Taras. The other stories revolve around illegitimate children born during the war to either Spartiate women and slaves, or Spartiate women and men not on the front line. Perhaps it was a state-sponsored breeding program to bolster the ranks of citizens during a long and bloody war, but regardless, the scions of these unions were still sent packing, no longer needed by their city. Personally, I don't like any of those theories, and the term Parthenii smacks of a later attempt to offer divine providence for this endeavour of colonisation. Professor Paul Cartledge briefly surmises that it was simply a matter of unfair land distribution during the war settlement, leaving still a dissatisfied section of the population. Let's run with that, and if we go back to Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus, there is definitely a story buried deep within the history of Sparta that lines up with the professor's hypothesis. In Chapter 8 of the Life of Lycurgus, the biographing historian writes that a second and very bold political measure of Lycurgus was his redistribution of land, for there was a dreadful inequality in this regard. The city was heavily burdened with indigent and helpless people, and wealth was concentrated in the hands of a few. It is, of course, impossible to say if this references the situation in Sparta before or after the First Mycenaean War, but I think it could speak to any number of times merely amalgamated into one story, much like all of Lycurgus's life. Could it be that this body of indignant and helpless people were the Parthenii? Disputes over the division of spoils was nothing new to the Greeks, even at this very early time. The legends of Homer were now beginning to spread, and central to that narrative was just that, a dispute between Agamemnon and Achilles over war booty. Whatever the case, the group received the Delphic Oracle, endorsing their enterprise, and the Pythia even told them where to plant the colony. With the malcontents out of the picture, perhaps the Spartiates could get back to the business of enjoying their victory. As we'll see, though, this conquest awakened a land hunger in the Laconians, and moreover, the Mycenaean question hadn't been completely answered either. More on that later. First, let's look at some of the positives that came out of the victory. It is said, unfortunately I forget by who, that if it wasn't for war, there would have been no temples and monuments in ancient Greece. As it was customary to dedicate a tithe or a tenth of all spoils to the gods in thanks, these dedications took the form of the beautiful remains we still gaze at today. Commensurate with that is the founding of the Temple of Artemis or Thea, which we looked at back in episode 17. Quite possibly built on top of a cultic site to an indigenous deity to Laconia known as Orthea, the Dorians conflated her with Artemis during the rise of the Olympian Pantheon. Located in Sparta, and open to all of her citizens, the site became important to the rites of passages for both boys and girls, and the journey into man and womanhood respectively. Unfortunately for the citizens, it was built extremely close to the banks of the Eurotas, and due to flooding, had to be refounded during the 6th century. Fortunately for us, however, they built up the site with a layer of sand which gives archaeologists a fantastic line of demarcation between early and late archaic finds. Its construction towards the end of the 8th century is salient to the Lacedaemonians' success in war and a structural dedication to their piety. Significant to the people of Sparta, the victory really put the isolated Laconians on the map. People started to take notice of these relative newcomers to the Peloponnese and Greece as a whole. It was also around this time that the epics of Homer began to be recorded and transmitted across the land in their complete form. Sparta played a central role in the epics and the surrounding legends. Succinctly aware that they lived on the land of heroes, they used some of the war spoils to tie themselves intrinsically to legend. In episode 17 as well, we looked at the foundation of the temple called the Menelaion, located near to Sparta on a substantial Bronze Age site known as Therapnae. It was also at this time, late 8th, early 7th century, that the site was first consecrated as a place of worship for the mythic heroes of Sparta, Helen, Menelaus, Castor and Polydeuces. A heroic and legendary past fitting for the new powerhouse of the Peloponnese, also serving to justify the recently established regional hegemony over their neighbours, remembering that the Dioscuri had warred against the Mycenaean royalty during the Bronze Age. Therefore, the consecration at this time was more than just a physical testament to Homer's stories and Sparta's place within them. It was also a metaphorical statement of Sparta's preeminence from the past to the present. Now we move into the 7th century proper, and it was a time of great change on the ancient Greek battlefield. I'll treat fully with Spartan military tactics at a later, more appropriate time, but for now, this period saw the rise of the hoplite style of warfare. Beforehand, war was fought in a more disorganized fashion, with loose collections of troops perhaps first engaging with javelins or slings, and then charging to resolve the conflict face to face. Horse-born aristocrats could literally run roughshod over the engagements in a fashion suitable to their prestige. The rise of the citizen-comprised city-state lowered the importance of oligarchs, and this transferred to the battlefield too with the rise of the citizen militia. There are several propositions as to how this method was instantiated, but typically I'll be going with Professor Paul Cartledge as one of rapid adoption, whereby, as soon as it appeared, it became so overwhelmingly preponderant that it was taken up with alacrity by all other states. Consisting of interlocking, serried ranks of armoured soldiers, the new Greek phalanx presented an impenetrable spear wall to its foes and fundamentally nullified any advantage previously held by cavalry. But where and when did this new mode of warfare first take root? The answer conceivably lies with the invention of the Argive grip, a two-point of contact method for holding the large aspis shields coming into fashion. As the name suggests, this technique was first developed in Argos, a powerful city-state to the northeast of Sparta. Consisting of a handle placed at the edge of the up to 1 meter in diameter shields and a fastening leather strap on the other side, it allowed for the wearer's entire forearm to make contact with the inward side of the shield. This gave the user extreme control and mobility. Placed in formation and locked with warriors on either side, it gave the ranks of the phalanx exceptional rigidity. Professor Cartledge places the rapid uptake of this new mode of warfare loosely between the years of 725 and 675 BCE, right where we are. This digression into hoplite tactics and the people of Argos's contribution to it is significant in that it was about this time that Sparta first contended with the Argives on the field of battle. According to Pausanias, in the year 669 BCE, the two cities fought a battle at Hissia, located to the southwest of Argos. Little is recorded of this conflict, save for the fact that Sparta was thoroughly defeated by its conclusion. We can discern from the location that the armies of Lacedaemon were the aggressors, as they were very far indeed from their home range along the Eurotas River, and only kilometres from Argos. One of the very plausible reasons put forward for the defeat is the Spartans' slow uptake of the new method of battle. As the Argives were some, if not the first people to uptake or institute the new technology, it makes sense that they would be dominant at this time. The Laconian response to the loss was not one of vacillation. The very next year the city founded the festival of the Gymnopedia, the dancing of unarmed or naked youths. Once again, I took a fairly concise look at the celebration back in episode 17, so won't rehash it now, save for its relevance to hoplite phalanx warfare. At its core was choral dancing for groups of boys, adolescents, and men in their age groups, which was competitive in fashion. Remembering the root of the word chorus in Greek simply meant to sing and dance together in cohesion and harmony, mastery of those two words was also essential for successful hoplite engagements. There was no room in the phalanx for individual brilliance. The mighty heroic duels of the Iliad were a thing of the past. Only synchronicity mattered. To an outsider, Sparta's penchant for music was as famous as their legendary prowess, and although not analogous to each other, the former fed into the latter synergistically. Distilled down, the 10-day festival was simply a yearly get-together aimed at honing uniformity of movement and thought for the time when it would be essential in war. I personally feel that this festival and its popularity, coupled with the citizenry's obeisance to the law, went a long way to creating the formidable fighting force it would become. The ability to move large bodies of troops in lockstep, to meet an opposing force as one with charge and thrust, and, to reference Jean-Claude Van Damme's finest, a no retreat, no surrender attitude. The adjustment in military practice was to be a fortuitous turn for the Spartans soon enough, for the Messenian question, which had been dealt nothing but apathy for 50 years, was about to rear its ugly head. What is known as the Second Messenian War is believed to have begun soon after the Battle of Hissia and the founding of the Gymnopaedia. More a revolt than a war proper, its consideration helps paint the picture of a Sparta riven by internal discord and insurrection. If the land settlements following the First War and the expulsion of the Parthenii to Taurus proved sufficient, what was the Laconian army doing in Argos prior to Hissia? Taking a tour of the Peloponnese? Unlikely. I believe they were deep in unfriendly territory for one thing and one thing only, more land. The best and closest, taking recent acquisitions into account, was the coastal foreshore of the eastern Parnon mountain ranges. A place likely under the control of Argos at the time, so in my mind, the casus belli can be reasonably ascertained as regional hegemony. It wasn't to be for Sparta, and take into account the destabilization any military reversal has on a people, the loss at Hissia assuredly stirred up fresh dissent amongst the enslaved Messenian helots, who were looking to test the strength of their shackles. It was to be the first true test of Sparta's regional dominance, and set the city on a path to reform in order to maintain that dominance. Further evidence to support the turmoil in Sparta at the onset of the war can be found if we put one of Plutarch's sayings of Spartans under the microscope briefly. It relates to King Polydorus of the Argead line, who ruled Sparta from roughly 700 to 665 BCE and was quite possibly the commander at Hissia. The saying reads as follows. As he was leading his army out against Messene, someone inquired if it was his intention to fight his brother. No, he said, merely to proceed to that part of the country which is not divided by lots. A reasonably eccentric recording to be sure, but one that suggests an element of land hunger within Sparta during the king's reign. Pausanias says that after having tried to unsuccessfully introduce land reforms via the Gerousia, or Council of Elders, Polydorus was killed by a member of that august body. An act of regicide to put down a radical program of reform. A plausible theory would be that having attempted to gain new land for conquest and failing at the Battle of Hissia, the king tried political reform at home. His murder would have left his supporters in a state of ferment, further destabilizing central authority and giving more cause for Halid unrest. Pausanias gives a lengthy account of the war, as he does for the first conflict which we went through on the previous episode. Scholars have debated the veracity of both accounts at length, and whilst both are works of almost pure fiction, the travel writer's efforts on the Second War seem even more unbelievable. From a geographic and military standpoint, the first is at least somewhat plausible if you were to plot out how Sparta would attempt to enforce dominion on its neighbour. His story of the second is more the story of Aristomenes, a heroic figure from Messenian lore who single-handedly orchestrates more than a decade of pain for the Spartans as he and his armies attack Laconia with seeming impunity. His recorded exploits are truly amazing. Captured several times, he always seems to find his way back to freedom, even at one point being taken to Sparta and thrown into the infamous Caiathus chasm, where criminals, unfit babies, and Persian envoys alike all wound up discarded, but not Aristomenes. No, sir. A large eagle swept up beneath him and softened his fall. Then, an errant fox guided him out of the cave's depths. At another point, he makes a solo and daring nighttime mission into Sparta itself, leaving a Messenian shield hanging from the walls of Athena's brazen house located on the Acropolis. as she was the protected deity of the city, this would have been particularly alarming for the inhabitants. The years go by, and despite a series of reversals, the Spartan resistance was galvanized by the poetry of one Tyrtaeus, an Athenian schoolmaster who was oracle-bound to save Sparta. His work revolved around obedience to the laws and personal courage. The words proved the difference, and after a protracted siege on the mountain fortress of Ida, the Messenians and their allies were defeated in a final battle, and the sounds of war quietened in the Peloponnese. The Laconians reimposed the fetter of slavery back on the errant helots and extended their dominion over the entirety of Messene. Ever defiant, Aristomenes continued his guerrilla warfare as best as possible with what little independent resources he could muster. Avoiding capture and execution to the end, he, along with his family, escaped to the island of Crete, where illness and death eventually overtake him. Although there is no reason to completely deny his existence, some of the deeds accreted to his legend would be worth the most stringent of scrutiny. Due to the heavily biased nature of the story, I will just leave it as this brief overview. Pausanias visited Messene during the 2nd century CE and probably got his account of the war, and particularly the deeds of valorous Aristomenes, from the locals. There is no reason to suggest that their hero didn't at some point exist, but like the Spartans and Lycurgus, all manner of mighty exploit has become wrapped up in the character of Aristomenes over time. Also, it's worth considering a people's cultural memory of a 500-year period of servitude. Who's to say they wouldn't be justified in attempting to rewrite history just a little? This is, however, the Spartan History Podcast, and we will deal purely with the unambiguous nature of the historical outcome of the war/rebellion, that is one of complete Spartan victory. Legendary account of Pausanias aside, and apart from Spartan victory, what do we know about the war? Well, as I inferred earlier, we know less about the second than we do about the first. What we can glean comes from the surviving works of a 7th century Spartan poet called Tyrtaeus, the same one mentioned in Pausanias' tale. The fragments of his corpus that have come down to us have been studied heavily to reveal a little detail about life in Sparta during that period, including the Second Messenian War. It is believed that Tyrtaeus filled the role of an almost state-sponsored poet whose verses were designed to bolster the martial spirit of the trembling Spartans, and events dictate that they had much to tremble about. Still dealing with general internal discord, they suffered a crushing defeat by the Argives, saw one of their kings murdered, and to top it all off, a general insurrection of their servile class probably made many think the end was surely nigh. Bellicose, fervent, and relentless, the songs of Tyrtaeus left a clear picture in the average citizen's mind of exactly what his duty was, what was on the line, and the price of failure. It's imagined that his words were sung around Spartan military campfires and helped turn the tide. Of his life we can say little for sure, though immediately discounting any Athenian origin should be first on the agenda. It's true that he didn't compose in the Doric dialect of Laconia, but his style of elegiac couplet was always composed in the Ionic dialect, the same used by Homer. Herodotus states clearly that by his time, only two foreigners were ever awarded citizenship of Sparta, and Tyrtaeus was not one of them. We should not be surprised that Sparta at this period was fertile ground for music. The lesbian poet Terpander travelled from his musically fertile isle to set up a school there, and accordingly, he created the choral competitions for the Carnea festival. Moreover, in the poet's own words referring to Sparta, "Here flourish the spear points of youths and the clear-voiced muse in the wide streets." We are aware of two, or perhaps three, separate works of Tyrtaeus. The first, which has significant remains, is called the Eunomia, or Good Order, in English. It emphasized the divine nature of the constitution, and that as it was bequeathed to the Spartans by Apollo, to trust in the god and his words would bring victory. The message is clear from the surviving fragments that martial spirit was sorely lacking in Laconia. The poem also references the First Messenian War and the efforts of King Theopompus during its later phases. What follows is an excerpt of that work. "Spartan heroes, martial band, armed to save the Spartan land. When, from bed of soft repose, will you spring to meet your foes? Mark you not the scowling eye of nations round? Hark, they cry. Spartans, are you dead to fame? Spartans, are you lost to shame? Halcyon peace has fled the ground. Hosts embattled gather round. Spartans rouse to Spartan toil, strangers threat the Spartan soil." His second work that we are aware of is known as the Precepts, or collectively as the War Poems, and they are just that. Battle liturgies designed to fortify the soldier's spirit during the heavy press of phalanx warfare. Take note of the following fragment's clear reference to the new mode of hoplite warfare. Let a man learn how to fight by first daring to perform mighty deeds. Not where the missiles won't reach, if he is armed with a shield, but getting in close, where fighting is hand to hand, inflicting a wound with his long spear or his sword, and taking the enemy's life, with foot planted along foot, and his shield pressed against a shield, his crest up against a crest, and his helm against a helm, and breast against breast, embroiled in the action, let him fight man to man, holding secure in his grasp haft of his sword or of his spear. It was with such words that Tyrtaeus is largely credited with turning the tide during the war. Despite the poetic nature of his works, Tyrtaeus is one of only two voices that speak down to us from 7th century Sparta, the other being Alcman. Not only are the pair of poets the only archaic authors we have about the city, they are the only Spartan voices at all to still be extant, and their importance to our understanding of this period cannot be overstated. Soon, I'll be doing an episode on women in Sparta, and Alcman's work will be a big part of working through that facet of the history. Therefore, more on him later. Apart from that, for Tyrtaeus, the only other thing of importance is a report from a 2nd century historian called Pollux. He suggests that it was Tyrtaeus who introduced the choral singing in age groups to the Gymnopaedia. As the festival began in 668 BCE, and presumably before the Second Messenian War, so too was Tyrtaeus already prominent in Sparta at that time. Unfortunately, we just can't say anything else about this war. My best guess is that it started sometime in the mid-660s BCE, and major hostilities probably ceased around the mid-part of the century. By the year 600, it's safe to assume that Sparta controlled all of Messenian territory, not just the Pamasus Valley. So the last 50 years were spent in slowly stamping out resistance. They couldn't afford the cost of half measures again. All evidence indicates that by the turn of the 6th century, at the latest, the entirety of Messene was under Spartan control. Another interesting piece of background data that shows the state of affairs in southern Peloponnese for the 8th and 7th centuries is the recorded lists of Olympic victors at the Games. They paint a particular picture of Spartan and Messenian dominance from a period before the First and through to past the Second Wars for Messene. Before we go through them, let's first consider what it might mean to participate in the ancient games. Although participants competed for themselves, unlike for countries in the modern variant, their state would still have to be stable enough to warrant healthy young men travelling to the competitions. Were they at war, just the sort of people that would prosper in Olympia would be better served on the city's front lines. Only the rich and affluent, those free from the seasonal concerns of the harvest, would be able to travel the distance to the games and support themselves far from home. So we can assume the pool of eligible competitors to be relatively small, even at the best of times. Our records for the victor at the Stadion event are the most complete and date back to the traditional beginning of the games, 776 BCE. This is because until 724, it was the only event to take place at all, but continued to be the games' premier spectacle long after the other disciplines were added. It was a 190-metre sprint, 95 metres and around a post, and back the other way to potential glory. At the 11 games, they were 4 yearly as they are now, between 776 and 736 BCE, an athlete from Messene won the Stadion race 7 times. That's almost 70% of the olive wreaths awarded went to what was clearly at the time a powerhouse of the region. We don't see another Messenian victor after 724 until the year 368, significant because Messene was only emancipated from Spartan rule 2 years before that. The decline of Messenian competition after 736 BCE is also poignant due to the fact that the First War of Messenia had broken out around that time. On the flip side, the 17 games between 716 and 648 BCE saw 10 Spartan victors for the crown, or around 60%. Not as preponderant as the Messenians previous, but the Spartans were fighting several wars during their ascendancy. Of particular note was a man called Hionis, who over the course of 3 games won 6 titles. The absence of Messenian champions for 350 years is glaring in its completeness. Conversely, Sparta's rise and dominance speaks to an affluent upper class with a leisure to pursue Olympic glory, freed, as they were, from manual labour by a recently indentured nation. By the turn of the 7th century, the people of Messene were a shattered but still proud people, chafing at their shackles, waiting for an opportunity to rise up. By the turn of the 6th, they are utterly subject to their Spartan overlords, and although there would be the odd revolt, it would take a Theban-led confederacy in 371 BCE to finally lift them from servitude. Apart from Tyrtaeus and Alcman, we have nothing literary to sink our teeth into for the Spartan story. Therefore, I'll leave the narrative there lest I fall into the intellectual gymnastics I mentioned earlier. I believe, however, that the period from 650 to 600 saw great change in the city. Although Pausanias gives us two distinct narratives for different wars, there are some who simply see it as one long, bloody conflict. Perhaps there were times of particular ferocity and other times where it was more of a cold war, but still, once the Spartans crossed the Taygetus Mountains and began their conquest, only total domination of Messene could halt their inexorable progress. If an elite caste of citizens from Sparta and Amyclae were to reap the fruits of a numerous and proud people, now in bondage, society would have to change drastically. The constitution was perhaps sufficient to enforce regional hegemony in Laconia. It was never meant to deal with an empire. Regardless of the dating and spurious links to Lycurgus, the picture of early Sparta in the sources is very clear. It's one of dysnomia, or utter lawlessness. Regicide, rifts in society, yawning gaps in financial wealth. If Sparta was to dominate, it needed stability. The wars of conquest, rather than quell the unrest, only seemed to drive greater wedges between the Spartiates. I think that after almost completely answering the Messenian question, Sparta took the issue of its dysnomia seriously and instituted a series of reforms designed to prolong her rule. I'm going to put forward that by 600 BCE, most, if not all, of the mysterious customs of the Spartans were in place, if not fully rounded out. The governmental apparatus was mostly codified and held constant for the next 300 years. Expectations for childhood education, women's comparative emancipation, and a general evening of outward societal practices were all beginning to firm up. The stringent adherence to a diverse religious calendar too was beginning to coalesce, which fed into the strict level of obedience Spartans were renowned for having to their elders and their laws. And last but not least, the Spartan yoke upon their enslaved neighbours was secured and incumbent. Moving past 600 BCE, we have a lot more literary evidence for the city's chronology. Due to the Sparta that goes forward being entirely different to the near legendary one we've dealt with thus far, we'll be breaking from the timeline briefly. I want to clearly define exactly who these people were and what they were about before working my way through the 6th century and onto the Persian Wars. Starting from now will be a series of episodes focusing on the various facets of Spartan society, government, and practice. We'll be looking at the different governmental apparatuses and their function. Heavily stratified as this society was, we'll break down the various strata and see the interplay between them. The women of Sparta were a force to be reckoned with by ancient Greek standards, and we'll deal completely with that to set them apart. Education and indoctrination were essential to future obedient citizens. That will need to be explored in detail to give context. The essence of eunomia is good law, and we'll peel away from Lycurgus the many reforms laid at his feet and put them in their proper place. Land distribution is a key thing to understand, for if it ever truly occurred, I see the latter part of the 7th century as the right time for it. Couple that with inheritance and austerity laws, these things are of significant importance to understanding the Spartans. And of course, the Spartan army. Battle of Hissia aside, as a force, they really started kicking some goals, and butts too, around this time. Literally, every facet I can think of will be explored and set in its proper place. So, that's where we are going. Up next will be episode 21, Governance and the Stratification of Spartan Society, which is quite a mouthful for a title and may change before release. That is, however, exactly what we were looking at. The formation of the government that came into the classical period and how it functioned, along with the varied classes within society and how they interacted. Thank you to everyone who stuck with the show last year and thought they'd check it out in 2021. It's going to be a year purely dedicated to ancient Sparta. As this episode will be dropping on the second Sunday of the month, I'll keep that theme up, so I'll see you next on Sunday, February the 14th. Until then, dear listeners, take good care and speak soon. And apologies to anyone who for even a moment envisaged Jean-Claude Van Damme as a Spartiate hoplite. I really can't get it out of my mind now, and a truly terrible reference. Please check out my website, SpartanHistoryPodcast.com, where I have extra information, photos, and maps of the areas discussed. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_history, and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from, and leave a review. See you next time.